I'm Sean Graham, and what's old as news this week is military experimentation. Militaries around the world have long been engaged in scientific research, with the primary goal being to improve their warfighting capabilities. But despite that being the primary goal, the ultimate results of military science and experimentation has plenty of effects in civilian life. If you look at, say, the First World War, a lot of the research that happened, particularly in the field of medicine, like x-rays and the widespread use of x-rays, as well as things like blood transfusions, they become mainstays of medicine in everyday civilian life. So there is this push and pull within the history of science and experimentation within a military context, but you also have this constituency of people, those being military members, who are having potentially experiments done on them and raises really important questions of consent. When military members volunteer in the Canadian Armed Forces, they are agreeing to unlimited liability, which means that in their legal requirements as part of their duties, they may have to risk their lives. But that raises very interesting questions as it relates to medical and scientific experiments and questions of consent. And that is the subject of the next edition of the Shannon Lecture Series coming up this Monday night, October the 6th, at Carleton University at the Dominion Chalmers Center. The speaker is going to be Matthew S. Wiseman, an assistant professor from the Department of History at the University of Waterloo, where he will be talking about Cold War consent, military experimentation, and research ethics in mid-century Canada. And Matthew has a chapter in the new book edited by Isabel Campbell entitled Cold War Workers, Labor, Family, and Community in a Nuclear State, which Sarah Hogenberg, who we talked to a couple of weeks ago, she has a chapter in there, as does Matthew, and his talk on Monday is going to be based off of that research. So I am very much looking forward to that lecture coming up on a Monday. And to get me even more excited for that session, I had the opportunity to talk with Matthew a little bit earlier. Very much enjoyed that conversation. Think you will as well. So let's get right into my chat with Matthew S. Wiseman. All right. And Matthew S. Wiseman joins me now. Matthew, how are you today?
I'm doing well. Very well. Thank you, Sean. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for joining me here today to talk a little bit about your research, medical research, as it relates to the Canadian military. Before we get into some of the specifics of what it is you do, what brought you to this particular subject? It's not so much that it's niche, because maybe it is niche, I don't know, but or how you would necessarily frame it, but it's a subject that I think when a lot of people think military history, the work that historians do when they're studying militaries and the armed forces, they don't really think a lot about science and making the connection between the two. So where does this come from for you? Where did this interest come from?
Yeah, that's a great question. I guess I will have to go back a little bit to the early days of my doctoral research in the fall of 2012. I was doing some research into a nuclear physicist by the name of George Lindsay, who himself was a defense analyst who worked in the Department of National Defense in Ottawa for much of the Cold War from 1950 into the 1980s, the late 1980s. And his employer was an organization known as the Defense Research Board, or the DRB, which still exists today, but under a different name, Defense Research and Development Canada. And the more I dug into Lindsay's personal papers at Wilfrid Laurier University, which had been donated by his family after he passed away in 2011, I became more interested in the history of this organization, the Defense Research Board, because I didn't know too much about it. And then I just kind of spiraled from there or snowballed into a wider fascination with the history of Canadian science in the early Cold War period.
And how does this research intersect, or what is the conversation between what you do and the history of science more generally? When you're looking at this era, Cold War era, 50s, 60s, 70s, where is the conversation between what the military is doing and what civilian scientists are doing?
Yeah, that's a fascinating, really important question. So it actually goes back to some big names in the history of Canadian science, you know, Frederick Banting and Charles Best and others, who themselves conducted medical science during the Second World War in order to support, of course, the armed services in aviation medicine and physiology and other fields. Those scientists, many of them were funded in Canada by the National Research Council, because during the Second World War, Canada did not have a government branch or body devoted specifically to funding scientific research and in support of the military. And so in order to fill that void, the Defense Research Board was created after the war in April of 1947, when authorities in the Department of National Defense decided that it was high time for Canada to have its own defense research organization and to pour government funding and resources into a variety of research and science and engineering and medicine and other fields, again, in order to support the three services, which themselves were separate at the time, of course, the Army, Navy, and the Air Force. So I became interested in the history of the Defense Research Board and in the sponsorship of science and technology and engineering research in Canada. And then, of course, that connects with a wide variety of subjects under the wide umbrella of military research. And in the context of the Cold War, the early Cold War period in particular, that meant preparing, you know, Canada's soldiers and fighting forces for the potential battlefield of the future, or Third World War, if that were to be the case. And in that preparation, there were a lot of medical scientists and a lot of individuals in the health sciences that were brought into the field and relied upon for their expertise. And those individuals received military funding through the Defense Research Board to conduct a wide variety of research.
And how different is that? You kind of alluded to it, but if we get in maybe some of the specifics of how different is that from what the three branches were doing before in the, so to say, the interwar years? Is Canada and the Canadian military, are they just out of science altogether and taking research from other countries?
So certainly during the interwar period and the early stages of the Second World War, certainly the three services, the Army, Navy, and the Air Force, did rely extensively on kind of scientific knowledge and new research that was being conducted in either the United Kingdom or the United States. So certainly the wartime allies in that regard. But interestingly enough, scientists in Canada took a leading role amongst the allied nations during the Second World War, especially early on when scientists in the United Kingdom, in particular during the Battle of Britain, were involved in radar and certainly defense of England in that regard. And they were just interested in other fields of research, where scientists in Canada, funded through the National Research Council, took an interest in aviation medicine, took an interest in protective clothing, took an interest in the physiological and psychological aspects of, you know, soldiering and morale, and were kind of took an interest and role through the National Research Council in supporting both the U.S. And certainly the U.K. and their forces in that point of the war as well.
So the Defense Research Board, when it's created in 1947, are these people mostly folks who were there during the war who are now staffing up this new agency?
So there were a number of Canadian scientists that would perform during the war what was known as operational research, and that was applying science, technology, and mathematical analysis to wartime operations. I've mentioned radar and kind of aerial ballistics and other fields in this regard. Many of those scientists, nuclear physicists, and a variety of fields were drawn from Canada. These were individuals perhaps that trained at Oxford or Cambridge and received their education. Of course, University of Toronto, McGill, and other institutions in Canada as well. But a lot of those individuals did perform operational research for the British during the war. And in the transition to peace after the war, many of those scientists who would have performed or worked for the British services returned to Canada and found employment in the newly created Defense Research Board. Under an individual by the name of Olmon Solant, who himself was a medical scientist who trained under Charles Best in the 1930s. Olmon Solant was the first chair of the Defense Research Board and held that post between 1947 in 1956. And so he relied on his wartime connections to draw individuals out of the British service, out of operational research, and to kind of build out that pool of experts for the Defense Research Board.
And how autonomous is this board, both in terms of getting direction from the military and therefore the Minister of National Defense, but also I'm wondering about the international environment. In the Cold War, you have Five Eyes is created, that alliance is there. You have UN stuff is starting to come up, NATO eventually, like all these organizations. So how is this board operating in terms of its, you know, deciding what researches, where's the focus coming? Like, how much of that is domestically driven and how much of it is based on international partnerships?
Yeah, it's another great question. So it was a lot had to do with the influence of an individual such as Old Man Solent and other senior, of course, advisors or officials in the Defense Research Board and in broadly the Department of National Defense. So Solent himself was the senior most scientist in Canada's Department of National Defense, but he was a civilian. And each scientist and engineer that was either employed by or funded by the Defense Research Board was a civilian. Those individuals did not hold military rank. So they were drawn from across academia, universities in Canada, as well as private industry and other fields and areas of work. Again, being contracted or employed through the Defense Research Board, dependent on the individual case-by-case basis. But because those individuals were civilians, they held a unique position. They were unelected members, certainly of parliament in that respect, but they did have the ear of senior government officials in D&D, as well as senior military officials across all three branches of the armed services in that respect. So they held a unique position. One, they were unelected officials in government, but yet they sat on quasi-independent government committees and panels, providing their scientific and technological and expertise and advice to senior officials, both in the Department of National Defense and the Canadian military more broadly.
And in terms of the composition of the board and the researchers as well, I know a lot of folks from Germany were dispersed after the war, a lot of scientists who were doing work for the Third Reich and a lot of people who knew science really well, who weren't necessarily part of, you know, things like the Nuremberg trials, all that kind of stuff, but they were dispersed. Was there any discussion or were there folks who came from Germany who were participating in Canadian research?
So I can't name you any specific individual scientists or engineers or researchers from Germany that would have worked for or were contracted by the Defense Research Board. That was a large and broad organization that funded hundreds of scientists in Canada. It also funded some scientists from the UK, as well as some scientists from south of the border in the United States. But beyond those three kind of North Atlantic partners, I'm unaware of scientists that were funded by the Defense Research Board. But what's interesting about that question in particular is that individuals in the DRB and senior officials in particular, even though they were civilian, as I mentioned, they kind of liaised and cooperated with senior officials in the government. And that included senior officials in the RCMP, who themselves were from time to time brought on board in order to conduct investigations or to kind of look into scientists that would receive funding from the DRB before that funding was issued by the federal government and by the Department of National Defense. Again, as one of the safeguards, one of the many safeguards that were established to protect not only Canadian science, but Canadian federal resources that were put into military funded research as well.
And to that end, do we have examples of people whose families had come from Russia or the Eastern Bloc, or even folks who had potentially worked with Eastern Bloc countries during the war? Do you have similar surveillance of scientists, the RCMP being involved in that side as well?
Yes, certainly so. And this was a broad area of the DRB that was known as scientific intelligence. Now, scientific intelligence in the context of Canada in relation to the DRB in the early Cold War meant a couple of different things. It meant scientific knowledge that was new, where there was intelligence officers in the DRB who held the responsibility to search out new, novel information about weapons development in the Soviet Union, for instance. But it could also mean surveillance of scientists that were performing research on the other side of the Iron Curtain in the Soviet bloc. And so through that scientific intelligence, both gathering of new knowledge and new research around weapons and military equipment, and et cetera, there was also a great deal of surveillance around certain scientists. I can't name any specific individuals because, of course, of that information, a lot of it is still closed behind access to information. But I have seen, yes, surveillance records with redacted names of scientists from the Soviet bloc in particular, who were surveilled in part because of the DRB, but as well because of the connection with the RCMP.
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense. I mean, there theoretically, and probably still is somebody still alive who was probably surveilled, who was doing science in this era. So, you know, that's why a lot of this stuff is still going to be redacted and not have access to public researchers. That makes makes total sense from a privacy perspective. So as we're looking at the DRB, I think most people, myself included, would probably think people doing science for the military is going to be mostly related to weapons and creating new weapons. But broadly speaking, what was the actual scientific research? What was the focus of the work that was being done by the DRB?
That's a great question. Another great question. And I guess my reply to that is how long do we have? There is no short answer to that. It's everything from aviation medicine, physiology, anything to do with the human body and the interdisciplinary health sciences, to atomic weapons research, biological and chemical weapons research as well. So broadly speaking, what defense research meant for certainly the Canadian officials and scientists who were engaged in this type of research during the early decades of the Cold War was any research that was related to preparing the military and preparing soldiers or aviators or sailors and otherwise to prepare them for any operational environment that they might encounter in the future. Not only to prepare people, the individuals of the Canadian Armed Forces, but as well their material and their equipment. So defense research could touch on all of these areas, and it did. And as you can imagine, there were scientists and engineers from a number of fields in Canada, academia, and otherwise, who would tap into the DRB because it was a large pool of money from the Department of National Defense. My research indicates that approximately 18 to 20% of Canada's entire national defense budget on a yearly basis between the late 1940s and the mid-1960s was distributed through the DRB for defense-related research.
And is there a sense of this stuff? Yes, it's in the focus is on service and how to prosecute a war, whether that is, as you say, with munitions, understanding how people might be affected in different environments. Like all of that is in the pursuit of understanding warfare and what happens in a war. But is there anything within the organization itself or the scientists, any of the stuff that you read about this stuff being transferable into a civilian environment? I'm thinking potentially as you're talking about nutrition. I'm sure somebody was studying nutrition and what to feed soldiers and all that. Surely that has some sort of application in a civilian broader environment. But is that the sort of stuff, or is that type of thing being discussed openly by the researchers themselves or by the DRB?
Certainly. One of the key strategies that defense scientists or scientists funded by the military and the DRB in Canada would use during the early Cold War in order to gain research funding for their work was to pitch both the military but as well the civilian applications of the potential research findings, otherwise known in the context of the early Cold War as the dual use applications of research, of course, both military and civilian in that respect. I'll give you one quick example. I open up my book with an anecdote about a scientist in Canada by the name of Wilfred Bigelow, who himself was funded by the National Research Council and by the DRB. He was one of a number of scientists who would work on an important invention during the early Cold War in the late 1940s into the 1950s, which would be the development of the pacemaker. And that was actually devised in part because of the military fund that was provided because of the DRB through research that was conducted in Toronto as part of what was known at the time as the Downsview Royal Canadian Air Force Station. And there was an experimental research lab at Downsview that was funded by the DRB. And Wilfred Bigelow led a team of researchers who would do research into hypothermia for instance, and through this research, they actually developed the pacemaker as well as other techniques to combat and to respond to hypothermia in the field.
That's really interesting stuff, for sure. And as we go through, though, I mean, as we get later into the Cold War, deeper into the Cold War in the 1960s, we do start to see, of course, anti-war protests as it relates to Vietnam and kind of an anti-military sort of mentality amongst a lot of folks. Do you see a similar thing, or does that sort of stuff affect the Defense Research Board at all, whether it's in terms of funding or in some of the projects that they're actually researching?
Yes, there were a number of what I'll, I guess, phrase as small-scale protests at DRB establishments across Canada, starting in the mid to late 1960s and into the mid 1970s. I'll just give you a couple of examples. We're speaking about Toronto. So on the University of Toronto, after reports about came out about Dow Chemicals during the Vietnam War, and there was some reports that came out that scientists at the University of Toronto had received funding in particular from the U.S. military or the U.S. Department of Defense. And then there was a connection as well to the Defense Research Board, and there were protests at the University of Toronto, in part protesting the DRB and the sponsorship or military sponsorship of research on campus. Similar protests around the environmental aspect and dissent in particular took place in southern Alberta at the Suffield Experimental Station. Now, Suffield Experimental Station was established during the Second World War as an experimental testing ground for weapons and for chemical and biological agents in particular. But that station would continue its research under the umbrella of the DRB during the early years of the Cold War. Some of the research at Suffield also extended to large-scale weapons tests with TNT. And there were reports about this that came out in the press, in the local press. And as those research experiments with TNT grew larger and larger, and there were reports that were leaked to the press as well about some of the biological and chemical agents that were tested on site, there were protesters that would come out. Now, in part, those protests, as you mentioned, were in response to Vietnam, but it was also a recognition that military research was ongoing on Canadian soil. And indeed, Canadians, as well as some Americans, actually would come north of the border to engage in those protests as well. And those would begin in the late 1960s and certainly continue into the 1970s.
Now, I couldn't help but notice as I was sort of preparing and I went through your book, you end it in 1970, right? So the title is Frontier Science, Northern Canada Military Research in the Cold War, 1945 to 1970. Folks who know the administrative history of the Canadian Armed Forces would note that unification takes place in 1968. I'm just curious about why the book ends in 1970 as opposed to, again, from an outsider perspective, 1968 and unification seems like a good place to kind of put up your hands and just say, all right, don't have to deal with that. I'm finished here. So what is it that makes the end point of the book 1970 as opposed to, again, what to me would strike me as a pretty easy narrative endpoint?
Yeah, it's an important and fascinating question, and certainly one that I spent a lot of time with as I was reflecting on and certainly writing and revising my book into the final publication. So the Royal Commission on Government Organization, which was 1960 to 1963 under Glasgow, that made several recommendations that, of course, would lead to the unification of the armed services, as you mentioned, in 1968. But it would also lead to changes for the Department of National Defense and, in particular, defense research. So the Defense Research Board would change its name from DRB to Defense Research and Development Canada. And that transition would not conclude until 1974, the mid-1970s, in that period. So even though there's unification of the armed services in 1968, the changes ongoing to government organization and specifically the Department of National Defense were certainly ongoing and did not end in 1968. Mm-hmm. They would continue up until the end of the decade and certainly into the mid-1970s in that respect. So I explore some of those change in dynamics and how that affected defense research. And the reason I end in 1970 is for two reasons. One, I traced kind of the rise and fall of the DRB during the early decades of the Cold War. but as well issues with access to information. Because I studied the earlier decades of the Cold War, and from a perspective of medical science in particular, I was able to learn some interesting information about kind of medical research experiments and defense research that took place in Canada. But it was more challenging once I got into the 1970s and into the 1980s. The landscape had changed, and the redaction or the information that I was looking into was certainly much more stronger and more severe. So those are kind of the two reasons why I chose, you know, 1970 as an endpoint. One, to explain that the changes in DND were still ongoing, and certainly those changes impacted the DRB, and naturally, of course, the science and engineering research that was funded by that organization as well.
All right, now let's get into a little bit about what your lecture is going to be next week on October the 6th, entitled Cold War Consent, Military Experimentation and Research Ethics in Mid-Century Canada. We obviously don't want to give it all away. We want people to come out, if you're in Ottawa, to come out to Dominion Charles for the lecture. And if you're not, it'll be posted online afterwards. If you're not in Ottawa, it will be accessible afterwards. But for starters, like, when you say military consent, Cold War consent, military experimentation and research ethics, in working with folks in the military, in what I currently do, one of the things they talk about a lot is, well, you know, once you sign up, the military can kind of do whatever it wants to you, and you kind of sign away a lot of rights. So when we're talking about consent in a scientific environment, is there a big difference when you're talking about consent for military folks compared to a typical research study?
Yes, I think that's certainly a very important question, not only in a contemporary context, but certainly historically as well. And I explore that in my book in a number of different facets and, I guess, a number of different ways. First and foremost is that some of the military research experiments that I discuss in my book, those experiments were not only conducted on soldiers or sailors or aviators, but those experiments were conducted on civilians as well. So certainly, you know, if there's military research or research that's meant to support a military agenda, and that research is conducted outside of a military context on civilians, I think that raises interesting and important, certainly, questions around medical research ethics in that respect. The other interesting aspect around medical research ethics that I explore extensively in my book is kind of this, what I term as a gray period in Canadian medical history in this respect. So we have the Nuremberg trials after the end of the Second World War in 1947 that established a base international standard for medical research ethics, for research involving human subjects, of course. But in Canada, in terms of laws governing medical research, in a military or non-military context, those laws aren't developed until the late 1970s and into the early 1980s. Mm-hmm. So between the late 40s and the early 1980s, you have this gray period where there are some, you know, there's certainly standards and there's cultural norms and practices, and those differ whether it's a military or civilian domain. But to ask the question of research ethics is certainly important in that context. And scientists and medical researchers that were funded by the Defense Research Board, these were individuals themselves that held certainly an important title. They themselves were the expert, but most importantly, these were individuals who made the decision of whether or not research was ethical or not. This was research that was not governed by any outside forces other than individuals in the Department of National Defense or military officials themselves. So those questions, certainly about power and about structure and military culture, are not only specific and unique and interested in military context, but oftentimes, because that research involves civilians, it bleeds over into the civilian domain as well.
So how is it possible to then understand informed consent within that environment where you do have this power imbalance? And is informed consent even possible when you have, in the military context, you have the chain of command and the expectations that you follow orders? And then for a civilian coming in, that can be an intimidating environment. And maybe you don't fully know what you're signing up for, what the conditions are. So, you know, as a researcher, how do you go about trying to really get a sense of what the participants maybe understood as informed consent?
Yeah, so what I do in my research is I try not to cast blame or aspersions on scientists who perform research for the military, but rather to use the lessons of the past, the lessons of the history, when informed consent might not have been there to the standards that we would recognize and certainly appreciate today, and to see if there's any lessons that can be gleaned from that history. And I think that's certainly significant and important to keep in mind. And that's what I try to do in my work, and asked for the question of, you know, how can we actually gauge or measure informed consent in kind of that past historical context. I think it's important to look at the documentation, certainly. Oftentimes, military-funded research under the umbrella of the DRB, the consent process didn't go recorded in written down in documents, and that can certainly make it challenging. So, of course, there are other sources that, you know, historians have, whether it's oral history or perhaps film footage, or certainly perhaps radio or audio recordings as well. And if we can build out our sources of evidence and try to see what the cultural practices were, what the standards and norms of the time existed, and if informed consent or any aspect of the consent process was recorded, I think we can kind of get at least a partial answer that way. And of course, the more challenging aspect of it is to build out the second half of the story, which is the story of the individuals who themselves were research subjects, either soldiers or indeed civilians as well. Those stories are certainly more difficult to get at. In the course of the write of my book, I found only a handful of instances where I had, you know, soldier testimony of being involved in experimentation that was considered to them, from their perspective, unfair treatment. I had no cases outside of newspaper records of civilians that I can point to that were involved in research that was considered unfair as well. But nonetheless, I think it's important to try to get both perspectives, both, you know, the perspective of the researcher and of the subject. And at least we can build a partial picture of the consent process at the time.
Because that's very interesting to me, this idea of where's the agency of the participant in the process. Because in terms of the final product that's created out of these projects, it's the voice of the scientist. They're the one conducting the experiment. They're the ones who are interpreting the results and putting forth their analysis. But the research subject, certainly as a historian, when we do a lot of research, we're using the voice of the people we're studying. In this case, you're using the resources mostly that you said are available to you are the voices of the people who are studying other people. And that kind of creates a really interesting dynamic, just as from a historical narrative perspective of trying to assess what is the agency, what is the voice of those people who are actually the folks who are participating in this research, and you hope willingly and all that. But you know, in certain cases, as you say, there are some people who would have felt that it wasn't fair or just.
Yes, and there are instances certainly in the history of the DRB and kind of military-sponsored research in Canada during the first half of the Cold War, where I can point to you and say there were safeguards in place, you know, where the DRB would send out specialists into the field. In particular, there was a researcher by the name of John Zubek, who was a psychologist who worked at the University of Manitoba, and he created an isolation laboratory to conduct the research for over a decade, subjecting individuals to sensory deprivation research. Well, the DRB sent a number of experts to study Zubek's research at the University of Manitoba and to actually question the safeguards that were in place to ensure that individuals subjected to the isolation chamber had certain safeguards at the time. But again, this was still very loosely concentrated way of consent. Certainly, in terms of the ethics that we were recognized today with research ethics boards, I mean, those standards were not in place at the time. So there were safeguards, but the safeguards that were put in place were individuals who themselves were either employees of or individuals that were contracted by the Defense Research Board. So it's very much in-house, and I think it's important to ask those questions of why was that the culture and why were those norms accepted at the time as well.
And all very interesting stuff. And this is why you should come out to the lecture next Monday night, October the 6th at 7 p.m. It's at the Dominion Chalmers Center in downtown Ottawa. It's part of the Shannon Lecture Series for Matthew's lecture, Cold War Consent, Military Experimentation and Research Ethics in Mid-Century Canada. If you're listening to this after October the 6th, I will put in the show notes a link to the YouTube video where you can listen to it afterwards. But before, if you're in the nation's capital, come on out Monday, October the 6th. You can also check out Matthew's books, Frontier Science, Northern Canada Military Research and the Cold War, 1945 to 1970. That came out last year. And in 2023, the edited collection, Silent Partners, The Origins and Influence of Canada's Military-Industrial Complex. So Matthew, for people to pick up copies of your books or to keep up on everything you got going on, what's the best way for them to get in touch?
Well, I have a personal website, MatthewSWiseman.ca, so you can certainly check out and get information about my books and related publications on my personal website. You can also connect with me, certainly over email. My contact information is on my personal website as well, so I think that would be the best way.
Absolutely. We will link to the website down below in the show notes, so be sure to check it all out. Very fascinating, very interesting stuff. And Matthew Wiseman, thank you so much for joining me today.
Great. Thank you very much, John. It's a pleasure speaking with you.
There you have it, my chat with Matthew S. Wiseman, and I thank him for his time. And again, do join us on Monday night, October the 6th, 7 p.m. at the Dominion Chalmers Center, Carleton University, for Matthew's talk. And check out the book, Cold War Workers, Labor, Family, and Community in a Nuclear State, edited by Isabel Campbell. So with that, let's get right to today's historical headline of the week, which comes from The Walrus and an article written by Matthew S. Wiseman, published on the 31st of July, 2025, entitled Canada Created a Cold War Isolation Laboratory. It ended in scandal. And this is an excerpted and adapted version of Matthew's chapter, which is entitled Overcoming Monotony, Sensory Deprivation, and Psychological Research in the Cold War, from the book that is edited by Isabel Campbell. So I'm not going to get into all of it. I really liked that this was there and available on The Walrus. So link into that in the show notes. Check it out. A really wonderful piece. You've heard from Matthew. You've heard what his research is. And that this was adapted and published in this forum, I thought was a very good choice for the historical headline of the week. First time we've ever done this, where the guest is also the author of the historical headline of the week, but not in this case, it was definitely worth doing. So, today's historical headline of the week from The Walrus, Canada Created a Cold War Isolation Laboratory. It ended in scandal, by Matthew S. Wiseman, from July 31st, 2025. And with that, I'll say thank you so much for listening, everybody. If you have not yet, please do subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Like, rate, comment, all that good stuff. Help other people find the show. Keeps us growing. Of course, head on over to activehistory.ca. All of our past episodes are there under the podcast tab, plus all the wonderful written material over there on the website. And as always, if you want to let me know what you want to hear on the show, what's old is news at gmail.com. Thanks again so much for listening, everybody. We'll be back with you next week for more What's Old is News.